I was asked to speak tonight on one of the primary episodes during Tkufat Bayit Sheni. We'll talk a little bit about the Tkufa in general, then we'll come to that particular episode, and that's the Mered Hashmonaim, and what it represents, and the significance that it has on that particular history. Every year in history is significant. There is always something that occurs that really has an impact on Jewish life and on Jewish experience. But to me, the history of the Second Temple era, the Second Commonwealth, or Tkufat Bayit Sheni, is of special significance because much of what Judaism is today, in Halakha, the structure of Halakha, much of that was crystallized and elucidated during that particular era. It was during Tkufat Bayit Sheni, for example, that we had the Sanhedrin, we had the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Even the Mishnah, which was written down later by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the year 200, nevertheless, the Chachmei HaMishnah, the sages of the Mishnah, lived during the Second Commonwealth, and they are the Baalei Halakha. They are the ones who really were involved in the Drush, in the various forms of Drush, and in the formulation of Halakha, what it is today. I mean, they were the ones who were responsible for Torah Shebaal Peh, for the structuring of Talmud, which of course ultimately became the source and the basis for Shulchan Aruch, which is the code of law by which the traditional Jew lives. So that era is of a very special significance for eternal Judaism, not only for the people who lived in that time, and not only for academics in looking back at what happened ages ago, but it really has an impact, and it explains what Yahadut is and how it became what it is and how it developed and the various problems with which the people were confronted in the formulation of Halakha. I was asked to speak about one particular development in this Tkufa that deals with the Hashmonaim. And it's important not only for the understanding of what Hanukkah is all about, but it's important because it's probably the primary episode, the primary event in Tkufat Bayit Sheni. It had an effect on Judea, which was the name given to the Jewish state at that time, in almost all of its ramifications, in terms of the government, in terms of society, and in terms of culture and theology. Let me explain. First of all, this Tkufa, when was it? The era begins in the year 538, before the Common Era. It was the time when Persia, when Koresh Melech Paras, when Cyrus the Great, became the victor over the Babylonians. The Babylonian Empire fell, and the Persian Empire began to dominate the entire era. And we read in Sefer Ezra and Sefer Nehemiah that in the first year of Cyrus's rule, he issued a decree of return, where he permitted the Golei Babel, the people who lived, the exiles who lived in Babylonia, he gave them permission to return to Yerushalayim and to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash and to rebuild the walls of Yerushalayim. And although Judea was to be part of the Persian Empire, he nevertheless gave them permission to govern themselves. Self-government became, and that's when Judea emerged as a country. It may not have been a totally independent country, but it was a self-governing political entity. So in 538, this Judea was established. And it lasted until the year 70 of the Common Era, that was already under Roman rule, when Judea revolted against Rome, and they lost that revolt. They were defeated. And it was then that Judea ceased to exist as an autonomous country, and the government was eliminated. And the Jews, although they continued to live in Eretz Yisrael, were now an ethnic minority within a Roman majority. Now, in the course of this period, came the Mered Hashmonaim, came the Maccabean Revolt, and which was successful, and which gives us the festival of Hanukkah. So normally, we think that we really know what this Hanukkah is all about. Probably one of the most popular festivals on the Jewish calendar year. Everybody celebrates it. It makes no difference whether you're Sephardi or Ashkenazi, whether you're Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. Everybody has a menorah. Everybody celebrates Hanukkah, especially because it comes at the time of the year when the world in general celebrates. That gives a little bit of an impetus for the Jews to celebrate as well. So you ask yourself or ask your children, I mean, what is it about Hanukkah? What's the celebration? What's the Yom Tov? And the answer is, well, we fought against the Greeks, and we won. And then there was the miracle, the Nes of the Pach Shel Shemen, the little cruse of oil that was supposed to last only for one day, but instead it lasted for 8 days. And that gives us the celebration for Hanukkah. But actually, it's much, much more. And we really do not give Hanukkah and the entire historic context of that event sufficient emphasis. We really have to understand what happened at the time, because it has an impact not only then, but it impacts us even in terms of current experience. This is when history repeats itself. At the time of the Mered, Judea was already under Greek rule. In the year 333, Persia fell, and Alexander the Great structured the Greek Empire, and Judea became part of the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great was a phenomenal conqueror. He was a great military man. I think that he is second only to Tzahal in terms of military prowess. He was a phenomenal conqueror. But he was more than just a conqueror. He wanted more than just to be in control over a vast area, vast territory, and over many peoples. He had a dream. He had a policy. He had something that he wanted to implement. He wanted that the empire should be united under one political umbrella. In those days, when we had world conquerors, all they were interested in was the tribute that the people paid each year. That was enough. He wanted more. He wanted a certain political philosophy to be in effect, which would be a force of cohesion for all of the peoples in the empire. And in the course of his tenure, it began to develop, and we call that Hellenism. Hellenism as a culture, as a political culture, and as a political philosophy, and as a form of life, actually, became structured under Alexander. Now, Alexander died after 10 years, and the empire was divided between two of his generals, between Ptolemy and Seleucid, and we had two empires coexisting, the Ptolemaic Empire and the Seleucidian Empire. Judea vacillated. At times it was under Ptolemaic rule, at times it was under Seleucidian rule. Ultimately, in the year 312, it came permanently under Seleucidian rule. And one of the kings of the Seleucidian Empire was Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the king against whom the Jews ultimately revolted. The question is, why did they revolt? This era in history represents a first in Jewish history. It's the first time that Judaism came into conflict and in confrontation with an alien culture. We really speak now for the first time of Judaism versus Hellenism. Previously, there were pagans, there were polytheists, there were idolaters, and Jews lived and mingled with them, but we don't find historically that they had much of a cultural impact on the Jewish people. Paganism really never penetrated, certainly not in the Second Temple era, but Hellenism was already a very major threat. The reason for that was because Hellenism was popularized virtually throughout the world. Josephus, for example, writes that anyone who was not a Hellenist was considered in those days to be a barbarian. In order to be somebody, in order to be something, to be recognized as an individual or as a people of note, you had to be in some way associated with and identified with the Hellenistic approach. This popularization of Hellenism proved to be a very major threat to Judaism and to the purity of Judaism. We always find people who are impacted by a foreign culture, but when they are confronted with such a popular culture, when it really means something to be associated with them, you always have a significant group of people who choose that form and who choose to become somewhat assimilated. And we had the same thing happening in Judea. What makes the threat in Judea at this particular time in history especially significant is that the leadership in Judea became Hellenistic. Striking, and people have difficulty in fathoming it, in comprehending this. The head of state in Judea, the political head of state in Judea, was the Kohen Gadol. The high priest in Judea was not just the ritual director in the Beit HaMikdash, was not only in charge of Korbanot, but during this Second Temple era, he was the head of state, and he was involved and he was the authority in every area of state administration and state activity, whether it meant war, whether it meant the marketplace. Any secular and any mundane activity that's part of state activity was under his jurisdiction. This high priest, the Kohen Gadol, was a Tzduki. He was a Sadducee, generally. By Tzduki, we mean how familiar you are with the Sadducees, with the Tzdukim and the Pushim. There was a political difference between them. There was also a great theological difference between them. Theologically, religiously, the Pushim, and we follow Pharisaic Judaism, we follow the Derech Pushi, where we accept the belief, the concept that Torah, Torah Shebiktav, as well as Torah Shebal Peh, are all min HaShemayim. This is what the traditional concept is, that we were given two things at Sinai. We were given the Torah Shebiktav, the written code, Chamisha Chumshei Torah, later on the Nevi'im, but in conjunction with the Torah, we were also given an oral interpretation, which was passed down, transmitted through the generations. And Pirkei Avot teaches that Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, Saral Yoshua, Yehoshua Lizikenim, Uzikenim, the Nevi'im, and so on and so forth, right through the ages. The Tzdukim did not accept that notion. The Tzdukim accepted only Torah Shebiktav is Min HaShemayim, and Torah Shebal Peh, the jurisdiction of Torah Shebal Peh, they eliminated. It's peculiar that the Kohen Gadol, who was the one who on Yom Kippur went into Kodesh Kadashim to pray for Slicha, Mechila, Kapara, for the people, that he was a Tzduki and he did not really accept the concept of Torah Shebal Peh. In other words, he did not act in the course of the year in his personal life, al pi derech halacha, did not act according to the halachic approach. This is the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol was also a very affluent man, and he was surrounded by the aristocracy in Judea, by the nobility in Judea. These people wanted Hellenism to penetrate Judea, because if they were the head of state of a country, they didn't want to be the head of state of a country of barbarians. They wanted to be the head of state of an entity that was recognized, that was on par, that was equal to all the other peoples and countries in the area. Yes. We'll talk about that in a moment. There were different elements. Well, I'll stop right now. I'll talk about it now. Hellenism consisted of a number of situations. It consisted of political, cultural, and theological situations. Politically, Hellenism, the unit of the Hellenistic structure, was what we call the polis, P-O-L-I-S. Polis is the title given to the Greek city-state. The polis was based on the concept of Athenian democracy. Now, you remember from history, Athens and Sparta. Sparta was the military unit. Athens was the political unit. Athens was a small city, and it was run on a pure democratic style, which meant whenever there was a problem, all of the citizens of Athens got together and they voted directly on the issue. And this became the apple of the eye of the Greek Hellenistic approach politically. Of course, when they had their own cities were much larger than the city of Athens, so this kind of a pure democratic approach was not feasible. So they introduced the kind of a democracy that we have today, for example, in America, where they had representatives. So they had in the polis, they had an Ephebium. They had other institutions that consisted of representatives of the city who were elected, and then when an issue came up, the representatives on behalf of their constituency would discuss and they would decide. So Athenian democracy, or the democratic approach, that was the political characteristic of Hellenism. Culturally, yes. Right, only the citizens were allowed to vote, and not all people were citizens. Well, I didn't come to that yet. So politically, it was the democratic approach that was essential to the polis. In addition to this, culturally, the body, the physical human body, was something that they virtually idolized. This was true of Greece. This was also true of Rome. That's why when you go to the museums and you look at the forms of Greek and Roman art, generally what it consists of are the different shapes and the different forms of the human body, and how, you know, the symmetry of the human body, the structure of the human body to them is the most perfect situation. So body was something that was very central to them. So every polis would have a gymnasium. The gymnasium, which is all right, I mean, nothing wrong with working out. I think that the Sephardic Center has a gymnasium too, but that's not the kind of a gymnasium that they had in the polis. In the polis, the gymnasium consisted of all the different athletic events, which were done in the nude. And this was in principle, this was not done because they wanted to be immoral. To them, this was morality. To them, to hide the human body, that was something that was wrong. Of course, from the Jewish perspective, that's an abomination, that's immorality, that's immodesty, and it's wrong. But the polis had that. That was very central to the polis, the gymnasium. In addition to this, the language, culturally, the language was Greek. Greek was the language to be spoken, and even the Talmud speaks of Greek as the yafeh shebelishonot, as the best and the nicest of the languages. In Greek, they wrote, Greek they spoke, they authored in Greek, much tremendous literature emerged during the Hellenistic period in Greek. Culturally, the philosophers, the classical philosophers, were part of the Hellenistic approach. Not only the subject areas about which they spoke, but their methodology was unique to the Greek mind, that they spoke with remazim. They didn't speak directly, but they sort of tried to stimulate and motivate each other with riddles and things in order to be, bring out the wisdom and the profoundness in each other. It was a form of philosophic dialogue in addition to the subject area of the philosophies that became central to the Hellenistic approach. And then, of course, religion. Every polis had its shrine, and the shrine was, of course, a pagan shrine where they had gods and goddesses and priests and priestesses with their different rituals and with their different ceremonials. This was the Hellenistic approach. The essential religious approach was that of paganism and polytheism. That was what was central. This was the standard. This was the norm. The philosophers as well. They were pagans and they were polytheists. There you have to understand that the classical philosophers divided between reality and between what they spoke of and between their philosophies. Their philosophies were not real. They spoke of utopia. It was all very academic. It was all very intangible. It was all very theoretical. They spoke of magnificent things, but they themselves were terrible people. There was really no consistency between the reality that a person was and the kind of life that he lived, with the kind of a utopian approach that he philosophized about and that he wrote about. This is the distinction between the classical philosophers and what we call chinuch, with the Jewish approach to education, where there has to be a consistency between what one preaches and teaches and the kind of lifestyle that he assumes. No, we'll come to that in a moment, yes. Philo of Alexandria was the prototype of the Hellenistic Jew. Dr. Belkin, Alav HaShalom, the former president of Yeshiva University, did much of his work on Philo, on Philonic literature. And he was certain, and he came to the conclusion that Philo was a religious person. Philo was a religious Jew who was a Hellenized Jew. By Hellenized, I mean is that he sort of, he was part of the Hellenistic environment, but it doesn't necessarily touch upon his own religiosity. So he looked like the Greek person, and he spoke Greek, and he wrote in Greek. And it's possible that he didn't even know Hebrew, but when he read the Torah, he studied the Torah from the Septuaginta, from the Greek translation of the Torah. But he's convinced that Philo was a religious Jew, and he was well versed. We call him Hellenized, but not always does the term Hellenized mean assimilated, like an American Jew today. I mean, we look around, we find that many American Jews who look like Americans. You can't really distinguish them in the street between how they speak and how they dress and what have you, but they can still be very much can still be very firm, very religious in terms of their approach to Judaism. So we speak of Philo as the prototype of a Jew living within a Hellenistic environment who sort of became synthesized. He was a synthesis between Judaism and between the Hellenistic environment that they were able to combine within their own life. That was Philo. But he was not the kind of a Hellenized Jew that I'm speaking of now, because what the high priesthood wanted to do was to introduce Hellenism into Jerusalem in all of its aspects other than the pagan shrine. There was never a high priest and there was never a Jewish leader, no matter how assimilated it may have been, who attempted to introduce Avodah Zarah into Yerushalayim. But, the last two high priests before the Maccabean rebellion, one of them, the first one was, his name was Jason, and the second one was Menelaus. Now, I don't even know what the Hebrew names were, because they are not mentioned at all in rabbinic literature, but Josephus speaks of them, and the apocryphal books speak of them. Jason and Menelaus, not only were they Tzdukim, and not only were they Hellenized, but when they departed from the high priestly tradition in a number of ways. Firstly, they purchased, for the first time we hear in the Second Temple era, where one purchases the office of the high priesthood. Normally it went from father to son, or as close as possible, there was a form of dynastic succession. Jason went to Antiochus, this was Antiochus IV, in the beginning of his rule, and he purchased the office of the high priesthood from him. He assured him that if he were going to become the high priest, which would mean that he would become the head of state in Judea, that he would introduce Hellenism into Judea, which was always something that the Greek ruler wanted, because Judea was the only country in the Greek Empire that stood in the way of this whole Hellenization process of uniting the entire Greek Empire under one cultural and political umbrella. This was the only obstacle. Pardon? Even before the Hashmonaim, the Tzdukim, emerged. The Tzdukim, why they called Tzdukim? They called Tzdukim because of the name Tzadok. They were based on someone. The question is who Tzadok is. According to many historians, Tzadok is the high priest that Shlomo HaMelech put into office, and we read about him in the Nevi'im. So if that's the situation, then we had Tzdukim going all the way back to Tkufat Bayit Rishon. There's also another source, and that's in Avot Rabbi Natan, who speaks of a Tzadok, a different Tzadok, who lived closer to the period of the Hashmonaim. But that does not mean that the Tzdukim emerged then. It means that then they began to play a decisive role at that particular time. But the division between Pushim and Tzdukim was right through the entire Tkufa, right through the entire era of the Second Commonwealth, and very frequently the Tzdukim, Yadam al Elyona, they were very frequently, up until the period of Hashmonaim, they were in power. You mean the Tzdukim, how they survived? We'll talk about that as well. We'll talk about that as well. You'll see in one moment, we'll talk about it. That's one of the ironies in history, one of the lessons in history. But let's get up to there first, yes. Well, they certainly feel that they were right. They certainly felt that they were right. No. As far as I'm concerned, even if the Tzdukim go all the way back that far, that does not mean that the philosophy of the Tzdukim, as we know it to have been at Tkufat Bayit Sheni, that was in effect in that early period as well. That could be something that came up in the course of history. Pardon? Absolutely deteriorated. You had a discussion here, I think you told me, on the Dead Sea Scrolls, no? On the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, there is one scholar, there's one young scholar who spoke in our shul. His name is Lawrence Schiffman, spoke here as well. Now, he has a very, very interesting kind of a theory. I'm sorry to go off on a tangent, but he writes in his book that there were religious Tzdukim and there were non-religious Tzdukim. So you see, everything has division. Just like the Pushim also were not all one-minded. They were more traditional and less traditional. Everything. I mean, we never had, our people are very colorful people. I don't have to tell you. Whenever you have 10 Jews, you have two synagogues. You see? So there's always a division. There's no such thing as unanimity in terms of our people. There are always different forms of division. The Pushim? It's not when the Pushim started. The Pushim is not the Pushim were not a party. They were not a sect. The Pushim, the word Pushim is not something by which they were known. The word Pushim was given to them. They were became known by others as Pushim. When we speak of the Pushim, we speak of an approach, of a derech. And the derech is what I had mentioned before, where they accept the concept of Torah Shebiktav and Torah Shebalpem and Hashemayim that existed from the time of Moshe. From the time of Moshe. When we have the concept of Halacha Moshe Mesinai. That's the Pharisaic approach. That's the Pharisaic approach. Later on came the people who seceded from that way. Of course, we can't pinpoint precisely when that happened. And they developed the Sadducean approach, where they accepted only part of it and they rejected the other. Why they did that? I have my own opinion why they did that. Yes. Let's go back to that. Okay. Yes, yes. No. If they were notorious for it, homosexuality was not a formal part of the Hellenistic approach. There may have been homosexuals, and may have been many homosexuals at the time, but that was not one of the policies and one of the programs and one of the characteristics of Hellenism. Yeah, because, again, that's because of that special infatuation that they had of the body, you see. So that sometimes expresses itself in that way, but not necessarily in terms of homosexuality. Would Judea have frowned? We have no sources at all. First of all, regarding the essential homosexual character of Hellenism, we certainly have nothing insofar as that having been introduced into Jerusalem, if it was part of that. Yeah, let's get back to Jason. Yeah, we'll come. But we'll do it. There's a lot to talk about, so we'll come to the other parts as well when we get through with this particular situation. So Jason went to Antiochus IV and purchased the high priesthood and promised him that he was going to introduce a form of Hellenism which pleased the emperor, no doubt. This is in the second century before the Common Era. This is close to the Hashmonaim. It did not take much longer when Menelaus, another Kohen, he was a Kohen, there's no doubt. He was a legitimate Kohen, went to Antiochus and said, you sold the high priesthood to Jason. If you'll get it for me, I promise you an even more encompassing and more extensive Hellenization process. Of course, this wasn't just a promise. This also came with bribes and with gifts and with monies and all sorts. And Jason was deposed. Menelaus was put into his place. Menelaus was an arch-Hellenist. Menelaus was the one who applied to Antiochus Epiphanes that Yerushalayim be structured into a Greek polis. And it did. It did happen. It was even given a name. It was called Antioch at Jerusalem. That was the name of the polis that was given, that was structured in Yerushalayim. He was the one who was responsible for the building of a gymnasium in that polis in Yerushalayim. The only Hellenistic institution that was not introduced into Yerushalayim was the shrine, the pagan shrine. The Avodah and the Beit HaMikdash continued. This is something that they never would do, that no matter how Hellenistic the person may have been, this is not something that he was prepared to compromise. This was the situation in Yerushalayim at that particular time. The masses of Judeans were traditional people. They were Pushim. Josephus writes openly that the multitudes of the Judeans during the entire Tkufa were traditional Jews. They were the Pharisees. They were the people who accepted the tradition as it had been. The minority, the smaller group, they were the Sadducees. They were the ones who became Hellenized, who became assimilated. But they were also the ones in power. They were the establishment. They were the established government. So although there may have been fewer in number, nevertheless, by virtue of the place that they held, both socially, economically, and politically, they were a rather significant group of people. Needless to say, there was tremendous dissatisfaction in Judea. The masses of people were very dissatisfied with the situation. Their government did not represent them, didn't represent them politically, they felt. It certainly did not represent them religiously, traditionally. Imagine the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, as far as they were concerned, was not a full Jew, was not a religious Jew. And this was something that disturbed them to no end. Then, within this context, within this kind of a picture, of a political and theological picture in Judea, the Mered begins. Now, what happened? So Josephus writes that one fine day, Antiochus came to Jerusalem, seemingly in peace, and the doors were opened to him without any kind of resistance. There was nothing to resist. They didn't anticipate anything. And as soon as he came into Jerusalem, he went directly to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple, and he plundered the otzar, the temple treasury. He burned the finest buildings in Jerusalem. He took 10,000 people captive. This is from Josephus and the Book of Maccabees. Both of them seem that Josephus is more explicit than is the Book of Maccabees regarding this. Does not give us any motivation. When we read Josephus, he does not tell us why Antiochus did that. But he did that. He came in and he did that kind of a thing to Jerusalem. And then, of course, the most abominable thing was that he went to the Har HaBayit and he put an idol onto the Mizbeach and he sacrificed a pig. He dedicated a shrine to Zeus or to Jupiter or to himself because he considered himself deified. Antiochus Epiphanes, the word Epiphanes means God manifest. He considered himself a deity. And then he issued a series of decrees against Judaism, against the observance of Judaism. Shabbat was not to be observed. The Avodah, of course, had to be stopped. The Kitfei Kodesh were not to be had nor studied. And then he imposed Avodah Zarah. He insisted that in every major district, an altar, a pagan altar, a pagan shrine be built, and that the people involve themselves in sacrificing and in worshipping Avodah Zarah. So in Modi'in, an altar was built, and one of the Hellenized Jews was about to comply with this demand on the part of Antiochus, and this is when Matityahu and his children and his sons came forth with a cry, and that's when the rebellion began. And they rebelled against Antiochus. That's the story. But that's not the whole story, you know? That's what we have to emphasize. We have to understand what happened here. They had a force. Sure, they had a force. He was the emperor. Antiochus was the emperor, the Greek emperor. No resistance. It's possible that they were. Let me talk about it. We'll see what happened. We have to understand what happened here. Why did he do that, first of all? So there are many attempted explanations, but there is one explanation that really is substantiated, and this is by truly a scholar in the Hellenistic history, in the Hellenistic civilization. His name is Victor Cherikov. He wrote many, many books on this particular era. What he writes is this, that Antiochus was involved in a war with Egypt at this particular time. He was fighting, this was the Ptolemaic Seleucidean warfare. He was fighting against the Ptolemies. He wanted to gain control over Egypt. And he was in Egypt. And the rumor had it, and Josephus mentioned that, not precisely in this chronology, but it's nothing wrong with that. You can create the chronology. Rumor had it that he was killed in battle. And when the Judeans heard that Antiochus was killed, they decided now is the time that they are able to oust Menelaus. While Antiochus was alive, there was nothing they were able to do because he was put into office by the emperor. An action against Menelaus is an act of treason against Antiochus and against the Greek emperor. They could not do anything then. But now that Antiochus was dead, they will eject Menelaus. And therefore, that's what they did. They forced Menelaus to flee Jerusalem. But Antiochus wasn't dead. Antiochus wasn't dead. And when he heard that this is what the Judeans had done, indeed, he viewed that as an act of rebellion, and that's when he came into Jerusalem and did what he did. Of course, in reaction, in response to this, came the military confrontation on the part of the people. This was not just the military, this was a citizen war where the Judeans, the masses of Judeans, rallied around the Hashmonaim. Now we have to understand here is that this merit, this revolution, was a two-pronged kind of a revolt. There were two motivations here. There was a national motivation to gain autonomy, to gain freedom from the Seleucidean rule. But equally important, and maybe more important, this was a civil war. They didn't just revolt against Antioch. They revolted against the establishment in Judea. They revolted against the head of state. We see this from the results. I'll come to you in one moment. We see this from the results when the Mered was successful and they came out victorious. Two things happened. Number one, they are independent. For the first time at Kufat Bayit Sheni, they do not fly the flag of another empire. It's for the first time that we speak of Judea and the Second Temple era as being an independent country. Fine, it worked for them politically. The next thing they do is they eject Beit Tzduki. They eliminate the entire Sadducean high priestly dynasty and they introduce a new high priestly dynasty, Beit Hashmonai. From that point on, the high priesthood is no longer a Sadducee from Beit Tzadok. From that point on, the high priest is a Hasmonean. And the first Hasmonean high priest was Shimon Hashmonai, one of the sons of Matityahu, a brother to Yehuda Maccabi. And then, so this is when the Hasmonean dynasty begins. Yes. It's not that you don't know what the source is, or you don't understand the source. From Josephus. Except that Josephus doesn't project it precisely in this chronology as an explanation for Antiochus. But when you read the entire context, the entire narrative of Josephus of this particular time, then all of these things that Cherikov speaks of indeed are reported. Well, what he was doing is he was not acting against Menelaus. He was acting against Judeans because he felt that the reason why the Judeans were rebellious was because of their religion and because of their insistence. So at this particular point, I mean, Menelaus was Menelaus. He didn't have any love for Menelaus. As long as Menelaus suited him, he had him. Right now, he was not going to impose Menelaus on the Judeans again anyway because it wasn't going to work. Right now, he acted against the Judeans. How dare these people rebel against him? And we're speaking of Antiochus Epiphanes, who was not a democratic president or what have you. I mean, he was an autocrat. He was a dictator. He was the king of the Greek Empire, who considered himself a god. How dare these Jewish people revolt and rebel against me and not follow my word? Rather egotistical individual. They all were. No, sir. He was reestablished, but not for long, because he was immediately eliminated with the Mered. So all of the Tzdukim were eliminated with the revolt. When the Mered Hashmonaim was successful, no longer was there a Sadducean high priest. We're not 100% sure about that. He's eliminated from the picture. He don't know. He certainly doesn't play a role in Judea anymore. We're not exactly sure what his end was like. Okay. So at that point, the established government undergoes a very drastic change. First of all, in terms of dynasty, the Sadducees are out, the Pharisees are in, the Hasmoneans are the dynasty. In terms of the character of the government, if before the character of the government was Hellenistically inclined, assimilated, now the character of the government is very frum, is very traditional. They are Pharisees, they're Pushim, because it was a religious rebellion in addition to being a nationalistic rebellion. You asked a question earlier, so what happened with the Sadducees after the Mered, right? I mean, they should have disappeared, correct? Well, they didn't disappear. I mean, they were around. It's true they weren't in power, but they were still the affluent people, and they were still Kohanim. They were not the Kohen Gadol. They were no longer in power in Judea. There are historians even suggest that there may have been some sort of an alliance between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, where they gave them some things to do. They gave them some limited authority, although the primary authority was taken over by the Hasmoneans. But interestingly, it does not take long when the Hasmoneans themselves forget the initial idealism that motivated them to revolt, and they turned Sadducean. You see, it does not take long at all. Take a look. So we had the first Hasmonean high priest is Shimon Chashmonai. Shimon Chashmonai is followed by his son, who's Yohanan Kohen Gadol. Josephus refers to him as John Hyrcanus. So it's the second generation of Hasmonean leadership. And the Gemara writes about Yohanan Kohen Gadol, Lebesof Yamav Na'aset Stuki, that at the end of his days, he himself already became a Sadducee. We are not quite sure as to what motivated him to make that change, but he already changed at the very end. Interesting that in Pirkei Avot, when Perek teaches that a person throughout his entire lifetime has to be especially careful of himself, he should always be on guard, never be apathetic and not say, well, I'm already old, I lived a good life, nothing else is going to happen, I'm going to be good for as long as I live. Don't ever say that. You have to be on guard, because the example is Yohanan Kohen Gadol was a proper kind of a person all of his life, and Lebesof Yamav Na'aset Tzduki. But this, politically, this is what happened. His son was Alexander Yanai HaMelech, who the Gemara writes about him, that he was a Rasha Metchilato, and he was a Rasha Bistofo. He was a Tzduki right through. He killed many, many people. He was responsible for killing people. He had a marvelous wife. His wife was Shlom Tzion. We refer to her as Salom Alexandra. She was the sister of Shimon ben Shetach. Who the Shatchan was to make that shidduch between Alexander Yana and Shlom Tzion, I'll never know. I don't know how these two people made a match, how these two people got married. They were completely in contrast to each other. If he was a Rasha, she was a Tzadekit. She was a marvelously righteous woman. But he did a tremendous amount of damage. When he died, she became queen. She ruled. She didn't have the title queen, but she was the power in Judea. And she had two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, and she divided the state administration between her two sons. While she was alive, everything was beseder. When she died, the two people began to vie with each other, and that's when everything happened, and that's when Judea lost its independence and became part of the Roman Empire. Pompey was at the time in the area, and that's when Judea lost. That's when Judea lost its autonomy. The important element in the Meret Hashmonaim is this cultural confrontation, which for the first time surfaced and emerged insofar as Judaism was concerned. And it seems that although they may have been able to. Handle it with the merit, but it did not last long. But this impetus and this interest on the part of the leadership in Judea to again become assimilated and again to become Hellenized, this is something that did not disappear. But the Hashmonaim themselves soon forgot their idealism and turned to the philosophy against which they fought at the time of the merit. And this leads to Chulban. Because from that point on, from the time of Yohanan Hyrcanus, we are able to trace the beginnings of the developments that ultimately led to Churban Beit HaMikdash, to his day, to what he did. I'll give you an example. Yohanan Kohen Gadol had a policy that when he captured a people, he forced them to convert. One of the peoples, I'm glad you took my clothes, okay, one of the peoples whom he conquered were the Idumeans, and he forced them to convert. One of the descendants of the Idumeans, who played an important role in the political history, was Antipater. Antipater had a son whose name was Hudus. Hudus became the governor of the Galilees, and Hudus was responsible for bringing Rome into Judea in a very fierce and a very severe way, which leads directly to Churban Beit HaMikdash. So if we want to trace the beginnings of the direction towards Churban, no doubt it happened during the era, during the ministry of Yohanan Kohen Gadol.
When we celebrate Hanukkah, are we just celebrating two generations of the Hasmonean Empire? I mean, after the second or third generation, it just turned back to where it would have been if it wasn't for the...
Never really turned back. It never really turned back. It did regress, there's no doubt. What we're celebrating at Hanukkah is, first of all, the determination of a people. It was the first time in Tkufat Bayit Sheni where Torah and the supremacy of mitzvot. Although they themselves may have degenerated a few generations later, that supremacy was really never lost. It stayed on. Yes. First of all, the concept of conquest, Hasmonean conquest, was something that was rather popular. You see, here again, when we speak of the Hasmonean wars, the Hasmonean battles did not stop with the victorious revolution. Once they won the revolt, the Hasmonean policy was to continue on its conquest in order to have a greater Judea. They wanted to add to the boundaries of Judea. Yaffa, the port of Jaffa, Yaffa was added. There were other areas that were added to Judea at that particular time. We find that that Yochanan Kohen Gadol fought battles, Alexander Yanai fought battles. Not everybody was in favor of that. The Hasidim, there were Hasidim, then don't confuse the Hasidim then with Hasidim today. But there were every generation, every age has a group called Hasidim. Have nothing to do with each other, but they're called Hasidim. There were Hasidim then as well. The Hasidim played a very major role in the revolt as well, but all they were interested in was religious freedom. Once their freedom was attained and they were able to eliminate the decrees of Antiochus, they left the wars. But the Hashmonaic leaders, they continued to fight. And that became his policy. His policy was a very nationalistic, a very patriotic policy. He's going to conquer a territory. He's going to incorporate and annex that territory into the boundaries of Judea. And he's going to make the people Judeans. Forced conversion on them. This is, of course, very contrary to the approach that is taken today to missionizing and what have to conversion. But at that time, this was the way. There was active missionizing at the time. Was it acceptable? Yes, this was the thing. Yes, yes, yes. This was not against the tradition then. This was then the vogue. This was the tradition then. Active missionizing. That stopped much later. In post-Churban, one of the things, for example, after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, that's in the year 135, so Hadrian was then the emperor. After Hadrian was, of course, a very severe emperor. He imposed all sorts of Roman legislation against Judaism and against the Jews. But after Hadrian, the Roman imperial government embarked on a policy of appeasement towards the Jews. They didn't want this kind of a confrontation to happen again. They didn't want to keep all the militia here. They didn't want this to happen. So they eliminated the decrees of Hadrian, but certain things were still left in place. One of the laws still in place was prohibiting the Jews from missionizing. So obviously even then, it was missionizing. There was a tremendous amount of sympathy that existed in the Roman Empire towards Judaism at the time. There were God-fearers. Josephus referred to them as God-fearers. These were pagans. These were Roman pagans who, for whatever reason, became infatuated with certain elements of Jewish life and with the temple. They gave gifts to the temple and what have you. There was a tremendous amount of sympathy in certain circles, particularly amongst the women. Pardon? Yeah, not only Syria, all over. Yeah, all over the Roman Empire. Josephus writes, and not only Josephus, the Roman historians write that there was not a place in the Roman Empire where a concept of Jewish Sabbath and Jewish dietary regulations did not exist. He's not talking about amongst Jews. He's talking about Romans. No. We don't have 10%. There were certain cities in the Roman Empire that had as many as 40% Jews, like Alexandria. Alexandria, which was probably the cultural center in the Roman Empire at the time, had at least 40% of its population Jews. No. There were converts to Judaism, but there were not many converts. There were more sympathizers to Judaism, but not actual converts. There were a lot of sympathizers with it. Like, God-fearers were not Jews, they were sympathizers, Jewish sympathizers. Pagan Rome in the 4th century, under Constantine, converted, and then Christianity in the 4th century became the state religion of the Roman Empire.
Well, that could have been the basis, because it was Christian. If you don't convert overnight, you have to leave the people.
We don't know exactly what prompted Constantine. We don't know what we don't know what prompted Constantine to do what he did. But not only did he convert, but he actually gave the empire to Christianity, to the church, that became the state religion, the formal state religion. That's when all the tribulations for our people began, when Christianity became the dominant religion of the empire. This is what I had intended to speak about today. Next week I'm going to speak about the later period. About the post-destruction period, and to answer one of the questions that was posed today, what happened to the Sadducees, also what happened to the Essenes, what happened to the entirety, to all of these different sectarian groups within Judea after the Churban Beit HaMikdash. And we'll talk a little bit about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai and Yavne, what he attempted to do, and of course that's going to give us the basis for the Talmudic era, for the composition, for the redaction of the Mishnah, the Tanaim, the Amoraim, the Saboraim, which leads us right into the Tkufat HaGaonim in the 7th century.
Did they function together with the Sanhedrin? Is there evidence that they sat together with the Sanhedrin?
Yes, we have evidence that they did. Yeah.
Did they have their own independent academy? Or again, did they study simultaneously? How was that promulgated? How was the...
Some of it we can answer, some of it we can't answer. Let's go to the first question regarding the Sanhedrin. There is a lot of scholarship on the structure of the Sanhedrin. There are historians, secular historians, who feel that the Sanhedrin was a bipartisan institution. And that's why in the Mishnah we have that there was a dual leadership in the Sanhedrin. We had a Nasi and we had an Av Bet Din. When the Mishnah speaks of the Zugot, the five generations of the Zugot, we had this a Mishnah in Avot, we have also a Mishnah Chagiga regarding that. The Mishnah Chagiga writes that when a Zug was mentioned, the first one in the Zug was the Nasi, and the second one was the Av Bet Din. So why do we need two leaders? So there are those historians who say that the Sanhedrin was a bipartisan institution that represented the two primary sectarian groupings in Judea, the Pushim and the Tzfukim. Depending on who was prominent or who was dominant at the particular time, that would determine who the Nasi was and who the Av Bet Din was, but that the dual leadership represented the Pushim and the Tzdukim. This is totally, totally fallacious. It has absolutely no foundation at all. And you yourself, logically, could see that it has no basis. For example, the last of the Zugot were Hillel and Shammai. Now, no way are you able to term Shammai a Tzduki. And when you go through the Zugot Bechlal, all the 10 people, Yossi ben Yochanan and Yossi ben Yoezer, and nobody there is a Tzduki. There may have been shades of difference between the two in terms of their approach to Halakha, but there is no such thing as a Tzduki amongst the Zugot, where he would reject Torah Shebal Peh. There was no such thing. So this is a fallacious kind of a situation. The closest we are able to come to a Sadducean penetration in the Sanhedrin, we do have a source that indicates that there was such a thing. They never dominated the Sanhedrin. But there were times when the Sadducees, when the Tzdukim, did penetrate. And there were some Sadducean members amongst the 70, 71 people. We know this from Megillat Ta'anit. Now, Megillat Ta'anit is not Mesechet Ta'anit. Mesechet Ta'anit is part of the Talmud. Megillat Ta'anit is a calendar. It's a calendar. It's a calendar of events, of semi-festival days that were observed during Tkufat Bayit Sheni, not biblical festivals like Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, Pesach, Shavuot, those are not mentioned. We have there Chanukah and Purim are mentioned because those are post-biblical events, but they have semi-festival days that were celebrated. There were two halachot in effect. One halacha was that you could not deliver a hesped on those days, you could not eulogize on those days, and you were not able to declare a fast day. It's a misnomer, you know, when you hear Megillat Ta'anit, what would you normally think Megillat Ta'anit means? A scroll of fasts, you know, you would think it gives you a listing of all the fast days. It's the reverse. It's a listing of the days when fasting was prohibited. Each one of those days represented and commemorated a particular event or a particular development that they considered significant enough to create a semi-festival day around it. One of those days, and I don't remember which day it is, but one of those days was the Yom Tov that they declared to be observed when they purged the Sanhedrin of its Sadducean members. In other words, where they introduced a purity into the Sanhedrin. The only rabbinic source, or the only source really of any kind that I was able to find, where it's pretty beferush, it's pretty explicit, an indication that there was a Sadducean penetration, but never did Sadducean policy dominate the approach, the judicial approach of the Sanhedrin. This never happened. As far as your second question is concerned, as far as Tukim are concerned, we don't have much information regarding the Tzdukim. You have to understand why. Because the Gemara, the Talmud, is a Pharisaic document, you see. So, on occasion, the Talmud provides us with some information regarding the Tzdukim. For example, when the Talmud gives us, when it records a machloket, a difference of opinion between the Pushim and the Tzdukim, we have a number of such machlokiyot mentioned in the Talmud. So from them, we are able to determine what the Sadducean approach was. But we do not have a Sadducean literature. There may have been Sadducean literature. There must have been some form of Sadducean literature, but it was all lost. It was totally lost, because with Churban Beit HaMikdash, the Tzdukim disappeared. Later on, in the medieval period, in the Gaonic era, Tkufat HaGaonim, that's in the 7th century, when the Karaim, when the Karaites emerged, the early Karaitic teachers, Anan ben David, Sahal ben Matzliach, they claim in their writings that they had Kitvei Tzadok, that they had the Kitvei Tzdukim. Some say that Tzadok, they have the book of Tzadok himself, because there is a tremendous closeness and approach between the Karaim and the Sadducees in terms of their theological approach regarding their rejection of Torah Shebaalpeh. So there must have been a Sadducean literature. But we don't have it, and we don't have any information at all about schools or any kind of a formal structure of this sectarian approach. Don't have that. Yeah, what he. Yeah. Well, we have, for example, the section. We can't refer to the Dead Sea Scroll, but it's probably the earliest fragment that was found before we even had any Dead Sea Scrolls, which we refer to as the Zadokite fragment, because Tzadok plays a very significant role. This is one of the reasons that directs Schiffman to explain that the people who lived in Qumran separated themselves from those in Yerushalayim, but they separated themselves from their own kind. Not only from the Pushim, but they separated themselves from the non-religious Tzdukim. That the people of Qumran represent a religious approach to the Tzdukim. If he spoke here, he must have spoken to you about MMT, about Miktzat Maasei Torah, because from that document, he's been writing a lot about that document, and there he finds a number of halachot that these people in Qumran insist. They write this letter to the establishment in Yerushalayim. Listen, if you want us to come back, then this is what you've got to do. These are the conditions that you have to follow. And they have a whole listing of situations there. A number of them very clearly speak of a Sadducean approach. So he said these people were Tzdukim, except they were religious Tzdukim. Well, this may be just simply coincidental. I have my opinion as to why they rejected Torah Shebaalpeh. Frankly, I'm not sure that I'm right. I think there's one reason that makes sense to me. These people were the ones who were in power. They were the Kohanim Gedolim. Where is the seat of authority for the Kohen Gadol? Where is the foundation? Where is there the source for high priestly authority in Torah Shebiktav? Torah Shebiktav. That's where high priestly dominance is indicated. Now, if you are going to subject Torah Shebiktav to a very liberal form of interpretation, where you are able to apply to the written word all sorts of hermeneutical principles and laws of logic and laws of reason, So you know what you can do with that. You can take something out of context, if you will. You can take something that's written explicitly and explain it away. In order for them to preserve their dominance and to preserve the literal implication of Torah Shebiktav, which gives them the scriptural basis for leadership, they had to preserve it. And they didn't want it subjected to any form of interpretation at all. This is my opinion. The fact that they were Hellenized is not necessarily associated with the idea that they rejected Torah Shebaal Peh. You have to understand that the Tzdukim were not conservative or reformed Jews of today. In order to be a religious Tzduki, a religious, sometimes the laws that they accepted were far more stringent than the laws of Torah Shebaal Peh. Shabbat for Tzduki was something very difficult to observe. He was virtually not able to leave his home on Shabbat because he did not have the flexibility of Torah Shebaal Peh. So the literal approach of the Torah, really, if they kept it, made Judaism a hardship upon them. So it's not that they were liberal Jews by being Tzdukim. Their Hellenization, or their assimilation, didn't have anything to do with Torah Shebaal Peh. It had more to do with the economic and social status that they had in that particular era. These were people on top. These were people who were very wealthy. These were people who wanted to mingle with all, with everyone else. These were people who continually looked for opportunities and for doors to open for even greater wealth and what have you. And as far as they were concerned, this assimilative process, this Hellenization process, would open all of those doors for them. So I don't think it was related at all to the idea of to the theological the section of the of Torah Shebaal Peh. Very hard to answer. We don't know. You see, it depends who you speak to. According to, if you speak to a secular historian, they will tell you that the original halakha is Sadducean halakha, and that the Purushim came later, which is very unacceptable to us, because if we believe that Torah Shebaal Peh is Mesinai, then that's the original one. We don't know when this rejection or when this approach became formulated. I mentioned earlier the Avot Rabbi Natan, where Avot Rabbi Natan writes that it happened that Antignus Ish Socho, you know, in Perek, when we in Pirkei Avot, before we come to the Zugot, we have Antignus Ish Socho. So the Avot Rabbi Natan writes that Antignus Ish Socho had two Talmidim who were very good Talmidim. And they already were so far advanced that they had Talmidim of their own, students of their own, and their students already had Talmidim. Doesn't tell us why, but these two people went off the Derech HaYashar, these two Talmidim, and they structured deviationist groups, both of them did. And then the Avot Rabbi Natan writes that what were these groups called? One was called Stukim Al Shem Tzadok, that one of the Talmidim was called Tzadok, and the other one was called Baitusim. So according to Avot Rabbi Natan, this is when the deviationist approach was introduced. I don't know if it was really introduced then, as I said earlier. I think it was vitalized then by these two people, but I think that the rejectionist approach already existed earlier. Just a theoretical thing in the Torah itself. When they talk about the documentary hypothesis and the all of this stuff, that there were different kinds of documents, you know, that were initially written and ultimately were put together by some editor, whether it was Ezra or whoever it may have been. So there were different groupings. They claimed one was a priestly grouping, so they had a document of their own, and the other one was a Levitic kind of a grouping, so it was that kind of a document, and all of them eventually were amalgamated and homogenized into this Chamisha Chumshei Torah. This has nothing to do with this at all. No, there's no dating on that. There's no dating on that. I can't answer that. Your question is very, very good. And I can't answer. I know the tradition that you speak of. I can't answer. I tell you the closest that I come. I know the tradition that says that that when the Kohen Gadol went into the Kodesh Kadashim, they put a rope around him, as a matter of fact, so that in case he died in the Kodesh Kadashim because he was an improper kind of a Kohen, then how are they going to get him out? Nobody's allowed to go in there except the Kohen Gadol. Be able to schlep him out with the rope. That's the tradition. The closest I come to this is there's a Gemara that writes. It was one of the machlokiyot between the Pushim and the Tzdukim was regarding the preparation of Ketoret. How the Ketoret was, that was the incense, how that was to be prepared. The Kohen Gadol, when he went into the Kodesh Kadashim, what did he do there? He didn't do anything in there. He had Ketoret, the incense. The question was, he had the Mishnah rites, he had two things. He had one pan with the coals, one pan with the thing, and then he combined them. Question is, when did he combine them? Did he combine them before his entry, and when he goes into the Kodesh Kadashim, it's already smoking? Or does he go into the Kodesh Kadashim with the two things separated from each other, and in the Kodesh Kadashim he combines them? It's a technical question regarding this. And this was one of the machlokiyot between the two. Writes the Gemara that there was one Kohen Gadol, a young fellow, a Tzduki, who decided that he was going to do this Derech Tzduki. He was going to show them. And he did it. He went in Derech Tzduki and he came out. He went in wrong. He did the Ketoret wrong as far as the Pushim were concerned. He went into the Kodesh Kadashim and he came out. He came out okay. And he was very, very happy. So his father meets him. And he says, Bini, he says, why are you so sameach? Why are you so happy? He says, what do you mean, why am I so happy? He says, look what I did. I did it the way I felt it's supposed to be done. He says, don't you know that what the father says to him, we may be Sadducees, but we are afraid to act differently than do the masses. Anyway, the Gemara writes, it didn't take too long, and this guy died. He died, and as a result of the way he acted, they refused him kvura, and they threw him on the ashped, they threw him on the garbage pile, they threw him there. Until his body began to decompose. So here you have an example that the Gemara gives you of a Kohen Gadol who acted wrongly and yet survived the Kodesh Kadashim. He died soon after, but he came out alive. I can't answer that tradition because we had a lot of Kohanim Gedolim who were improper. And they survived. Yes. No, because you see, they had a problem with tradition. The Pushim, sometimes there are traditions that you are unhappy with, but nevertheless, you will not act against tradition. And the tradition was, as long as it may have been, and here we have the academic controversy as to when this tradition began, but the tradition was that the Kohen Gadol comes from Beit Tzadok. That it's got to be a biological descendant of this Zadokite dynasty. That was the tradition. That was the tradition. They could not act against it. Truthfully, the apocryphal books write that even after the Mered, even after the revolt, when the Hasmoneans won, they were hesitant too in rejecting and in ejecting the Tzdukim because of this tradition. So the Book of Maccabees writes that when they declared Shimon Chashmonai to be the Kohen Gadol, they said, until a Navi Emet, until a proper prophet will arise and correct us if we need to be corrected. So even they acted with hesitation against this tradition in ejecting introducing a new dynasty, a new Ifusli dynasty. This was the situation. Before that, they certainly didn't try. We don't have any indication at all. Throughout, we were speaking about half of a Tkufa. We're speaking the second century, and it started in the fourth century, the fifth century. And there was at no time was there a revolt or even talk of a revolt. Not that far from the Sefer Yovelim. The Sefer Yovelim in certain areas is more stringent than the halakha that we have. For example, like in Sefer Yovelim, we have an indication that in those days, that's in the Hellenistic time, Sefer Yomim was written in the Hellenistic period. The Apocrypha is a Hellenistic literature. Over there, the indication is that in those days, warfare on Shabbat, even defensive warfare on Shabbat, was prohibited. And we know that this was the approach in the beginning of the Hasmonean Rebellion. It was during the Hasmonean Rebellion that a change was introduced, that defensive warfare should be prohibited. Yeah. Pardon? The old halakha, the accepted tradition initially was that the people would not fight on Shabbat, no way, no matter what. They did. That's why it was changed. The people, they did. Josephus writes, what they used to do is they used to wait for Shabbat and they would attack the Judeans. And the Judeans would not defend themselves. So that's when Yehuda and the others got up and said, if this is the way you are going to observe Shabbat, it will not take long and there will be nobody around to observe Shabbat. Pardon? We don't know about the First Temple period. We don't have any sources of the First Temple period other than the Nevi'im. Other than the Nevi'im, we don't have. Yeah.
Well, how many there was the Pach Shemen?
Yeah, the Pach Shemen, no? Pardon?
The
Nase of Pach Shemen, what about it?
How major it was?
Yeah, because it's a good story. It's a very good. I don't know. I don't know that it was very major at the time. I don't know that it was very major. I think that it's there. It's there. You have to know. We have two traditions in the rabbinic literature. We have the Pach. You know, we have the Pach Shel Shemen, and we use the Pach Shel Shemen. We emphasize that, and that explains why we light candles. Correct? For eight days. That's it. But there's another tradition. There's a Psikta Rabati, where it tells you a totally different story. Over there, the Psikta writes that when the Hashmonaim came into the Azara, they found Shmone Shipudin Shel Barzel. They found 8 iron spears that the Greeks had left when they retreated. There were Greek armaments, and when the Greeks ran away from the revolutionaries, they found these 8. And what they did was they took the 8 shipudin, and they put them into the ground, and they made them into torches. They ignited them. So this, according to the Psikta, gives us the number 8 and the flames associated with 8 flames, with 8 candles. You have another rabbinic tradition as well, you see. The shipudin shel barzel would be a nationalistic approach, a military approach to the menorah. The Pach Shel Shemen is a purely mystical approach, but it's more than just mystical. What it expresses is the divine providence, you know, the Hashkacha Prati, the Hashkacha of Hashem on Bnei Yisrael. Well, why? You don't have to. You could accept that they didn't have time. The thing is this, that even if they didn't have time and there was only something that was tamei, they still could have used it according to halakha. Even if it was tamei, if there's nothing tahor, then you're able to do that.
We
believe it happened. We believe. I don't know that. It's very difficult to date. The thing is, you have to understand the whole celebration of Chanukah, the whole concept of menorah and Chanukah, that is late. That was not part of the initial Chanukah celebration at the time of the Beit HaMikdash.
Yeah, what were they doing after, year after?
What? Well, even a year after. We don't know that they did a menorah. You know what they did? I'll tell you what they did. First of all, they had the Korbanot in the Beit HaMikdash. They said Hallel. There's no doubt about that. They said Hallel. And they had a parade. They had a torchlight parade. That's in the Book of Maccabees. That's one Gemara that we have regarding that. But you take a look. If you take a look, you know, the peculiarity is that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai that were already years and years after this entire event still did not have a clear approach for the Hadlakat Nerot Shel Chanukah. On Chanukah. On Chanukah. Yes, at the same time. I mean, there's no doubt that they were Koveya. That time became, that's for sure, that they did designate that those days, they did designate those days, which were the days of Chanukat HaMizbeach. Those were the days that were designated for the Yom Tov. Yes. As a matter of fact, the 25th day of Kislev represented two things. It represented, number one, the dedication of the Mizbeach. It also represented the desecration of the Mizbeach 3 years earlier, that same day. So it was a very decisive day. Yeah.
I heard the reason for emphasizing fast famine over the military aspect is the rabbis wanted to downplay the military aspect because they had a lot of
hatchet. I think that they wanted to downplay the dominance of the Hashmonaim. Because after a while, as we mentioned earlier, there was a deterioration at Beit Hashmonai. And they didn't want them to be way up on top, and they wanted to downplay their initial glory with their role in the merit.
Yeah, but that happened much later.
Well, the Gemara was written down much later.
Maybe because of Bar Kokhba.
After Bar Kokhba, they downplayed any kind of militancy. Yeah, so it's possible, there's no doubt. I mean, you are correct.
Yeah.
You are correct. Because they went through a disaster in their revolt against Rome. They went through a disaster in the defeat of Bar Kokhba, with the defeat of Beitar. Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And they wanted to downplay militancy. Don't say those things. I didn't make up a story. But that's when they included the tradition.
Listen, I have a question.
Yes.
I don't understand the answer for why didn't they try to get it back?
They did. I mean, how can they try to get it back? If they were a minority, you couldn't expect them to revolt against the majority. How could they try to get it? They couldn't try actively to get it back. As I've mentioned before, some people suggest that they were given some piece of the government, that there was an alliance between the two. But truthfully speaking, the Sadducees did come back into power, beginning with Yochanan Kohen Gadol and Alexander Yana. Maybe they weren't the high priests, but they were dominant. They were dominant people in the government. Yes, Hashmonai is a family. Was the family? You see, that's the proper name to be given to that group, Hashmonai, because the Maccabim, when we refer to them as Maccabim, that's a misnomer. The only one who was called Maccabi was Yehuda. And we don't even know exactly what the word Maccabi means. We generally accept Maccabi as being Mi Kamocha Ba'elim Adoshem. But historians say that Maccabi means hammerhead. He had a peculiar structure. No, it really Maccabim, the word Maccabim applies only to one person. Only to Yehuda. Matityahu Kohen Gadol? No, but he was a chief priest. No. Let me tell you what happened then. There was never a Matityahu Kohen Gadol in Yerushalayim. There was never one like that. But Yehuda was divided into districts. That was done yet in the time of Ezra, when we had the Mishmarot and the Ma'amadot. Each district had Kohanim, Leviim, and Yisraelim. And each district had a chief priest, a Kohen Gadol of its district, and this is what Matityahu was. But he was not Kohen Gadol in Yerushalayim. There was no such thing. Yeah, it's a mistake. Not that it's not a mistake. It's just that we mistranslate Kohen Gadol in relation to him. I thank you, people.